Russia has been dominating the news cycles lately. Allegations that Russia hacked computers at the Democratic National Committee have now morphed into reports that the Central Intelligence Agency has concluded that Russian President Vladimir Putin personally directed an effort to tip the U.S. presidential election in Donald Trump's favor. Mr. Trump's rejection of the CIA assessment as ridiculous has only further fueled the controversy. All of this comes against the backdrop of a political campaign in which then-candidate Trump spoke frequently about rebuilding relations with Russia. He talked about the possibility that the United States and Russia could partner to defeat the Islamic State. Here he is at a campaign rally in Ohio just a few months before the election.
Wouldn't it be great if we actually got along with Russia? Am I wrong in saying that? Wouldn't it be great? Okay? You know, Russia, like us, has nuclear weapons, folks. It would be really nice if we got along with Russia and others that we don't get along with right now. And wouldn't it be nice if we teamed up with Russia and others, including surrounding states and maybe NATO, and we knocked the hell out of ISIS and got rid of these people? Wouldn't that be nice? Right?
I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations.
And I'm Bob McMahon, Managing Editor of CFR.org.
You're listening to The President's Inbox, a CFR podcast that examines the challenges President-elect Trump will face after Inauguration Day on January 20th, 2017. On this show, we will talk about the issues that he will find at the top of his inbox when he arrives in the Oval Office. We're going to discuss what he has said he will do, what his priorities might be, and what challenges he could likely confront. This week, we're going to talk about Russia. How will President-elect Donald Trump handle relations with the Kremlin during his presidency?
With us this week to help examine that is CFR's Stephen Sestanovich. Steve is a senior fellow focusing on Russian and Eurasian studies and a professor of international diplomacy at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs. From 1997 to 2001, Steve served as U.S. State Department's ambassador at large for the former Soviet states, and he is the author of Maximalist: America in the World from Truman to Obama. Steve, thanks for being here.
Pleasure.
It is hard to overstate, as Jim noted, the level of anticipation to Russian policy in the incoming administration. So, Steve, what is your take on how the administration might be handling Russian policy?
Well, it's going to be conducting, in some sense, the same review that administrations always do and have over the past 25 years since the end of the Cold War. Do they see Russia as a partner, an adversary? Do they want a relationship that's primarily quid pro quo, transactional, or do they think there's a broader strategic foundation that can be given to the relationship that helps to drive cooperation forward? You know, almost every administration since the end of the Cold War has sought a reset, an improvement of relations with Russia. So in that sense, what the Trump administration will be doing is not so new. What's different is that the effort to improve relations comes against the backdrop of a real challenge to the whole idea that Russia and the U.S. can be partners. A deterioration of relations over the past 3 years, and especially in the course of the campaign, that has made it, for many people, hard to think of Russia as a partner. That's why the claim that Trump made in the campaign that he and Putin could get along beautifully was received so skeptically or with such horror by so many people. There's another element to it, though, which is that the policymakers involved in making and setting policy toward Russia all have a kind of questionable relationship with the country and with the leadership. And we can talk more about that, but that makes it easy for other people in Washington to push back against the administration's efforts.
Well, certainly, Steve, as you look at how the discussion of Russia has unfolded since the election, a number of members of Congress, particularly a number of senators, particularly Republican senators, have expressed great concern as to what they see or have depicted as too much softness on the part of Mr. Trump toward Russia. Can you just maybe walk us through and help us understand what the complaint is and how significant you think it might be going forward?
Well, let's start with Trump, but I don't want to leave it at him because I think other members of his team are vulnerable to the same kind of criticism. Trump has been an advocate of improved relations because he says, you know, the United States and Russia should be able to cooperate on the main challenge that he sees in American foreign policy, which is fighting ISIS. He has suggested that to that end, he would be willing to brush aside the problem of Ukraine, ease sanctions, possibly downgrade our commitments to NATO allies. And in doing that, he's challenging the really fundamental tenets of American foreign policy. So that's excited people in the Congress and in the foreign policy establishment in general. He has also rejected suggestions from the intelligence community about Russia's role in the hacking of the DNC and in the dissemination of all these leaked documents. The quote that we heard from it is that he called these claims ridiculous. And so you get pushback there, not just from members of Congress, but from the intelligence community itself. These are people who are antagonized by the suggestions of this kind. Trump is saying their professional bona fides are in question, or that they're idiots.
Well, Steve, you wrote a great book, The Maximalist, and I would refer our readers to it, encourage them.
Yes, available at a famous online bookseller.
Well, but it's a great overview of American foreign policy, presidential approaches to foreign policy going back to the days of Harry Truman. And you talk about sort of ebbs and flows in American foreign policy, that periods in which sort of presidents try to maximize American power on the globe are followed by periods of retrenchment. And we describe, I think, George W. Bush's presidency as a period of maximalism and Barack Obama's as a period of retrenchment. Where do you see a Donald Trump presidency fitting into that schema?
Donald Trump represents a kind of puzzle because he has both elements of activism, promising to, you know, start winning again, rejecting what he calls the weakness of the Obama administration, saying that we're going to make America great again. All of that is the rhetoric of our activist presidents. At the same time, he seems to have the view that a lot of our foreign policy commitments have been unprofitable for the United States. A lot of the initiatives taken involving us in the ways we've involved ourselves in the international economy have been detrimental to Americans. And that represents the classic view of retrenchment presidents. The idea, just to tie this back to Russia, that you reach out to adversaries to solve your problems, say, you know, we're gonna do less. We're hoping you'll do more. That's a classic trope of a retrenchment president. So Trump is playing with both of these themes, yet got a bead on which one of them is going to dominate, whether he's going to be able to push this activist, hyper-involved view that seems in some ways consistent with what we know of his political personality, or whether he's going to actually reduce American involvement in the world.
But obviously, presidents make foreign policy, but they do not make it entirely by themselves. What do we know about the other members of the Trump foreign policy national security team in terms of their attitudes and approaches toward Russia?
Well, this is what is a real problem for the Trump administration trying to articulate a new approach to Russia, because there's a real challenge made to the legitimacy of not just the president's views, but those of his national security advisor, his nominee for Secretary of State. General Flynn, the national security advisor, is well known as an advocate of cooperation with Russia, with President Putin. He's famously attended this anniversary dinner for RT, the Russian propaganda arm, sitting next to Putin, presumably for a handsome fee. And so his view that there should be a kind of cooperation, it has that taint to it. Rex Tillerson, the CEO of Exxon, who's been nominated to be Secretary of State, has an even closer relationship with the Russian leadership. He has pursued very important contracts for his oil company in Russia. You know, the estimates here run to the hundreds of billions of dollars in the value for Exxon. And he has challenged American policy over the past couple of years, saying that sanctions don't work, suggesting that as Secretary of State, he might try to dismantle the sanctions regime imposed on Russia after its aggression in Ukraine. So both of these guys, presumably the president's closest advisors on relations with Russia, have got this shadow over their views. I would expect that for Secretary Designate Tillerson, this will be the focus of his confirmation hearings. People will say not just, are you too sympathetic to Putin, but don't you have a conflict of interest that makes it impossible for you to judge the American national interest properly? Well, don't you have too much riding on removing sanctions from Russia?
So the confirmation hearings bring up an interesting point, Stephen, which is the incoming administration's relationship with its own party on Russia in particular. You have, it's been pointed out already quite a bit, you have distinctive strains in the Republican Party that have very strong views about Russia. You know, there are Republicans who very vigorously backed the Magnitsky Act, for example, who were very strongly opposed to the annexation of Crimea and are supporting ongoing sanctions and are very critical of Russian actions in Syria and so forth. And there are others who are, say, you know, less bothered by Russian actions and might be willing to cast their lot in with the administration. But how do you see that playing out, that relationship with Congress and its own party?
You're absolutely right that there are going to be questions raised about Tillerson's view of Russia, about Trump's and Flynn's. But in Congress, typically you need some focus for that kind of challenge. For Republicans and Democrats who don't like the drift of administration, the new administration's policy toward Russia, they do have that focus, which is investigating Russian involvement in the hacking and in the attempts to interfere with the election. This is something that is, of course, embarrassing for the president, and not just because he's denied it, said it was ridiculous and so forth, but because he is the beneficiary if it seems that the Russians did interfere in order to help him win. So when he dismisses these charges, it looks as though there's bad faith involved. Republicans and Democrats in Congress always have trouble challenging any administration's foreign policy. The executive branch has the initiative and the advantage in setting foreign policy. But when you've got a really hot issue like, did the Russians interfere in our election, and you know that elements of the executive branch are opposed to the president, you've got great material to work with. And these hearings could be really pretty lively.
So the challenge you're going to face there is that the information the intelligence communities have is information that is secret, and they can disclose the conclusions they've drawn based on information, but I would imagine they'll be very reluctant to share in any detail how they got it, because that raises sources and methods. But many people will argue that unless you can show me some concrete evidence as to Russians doing this, this is all made up.
There are going to be different ways in which intelligence community professionals make their case to the Congress. Some of it will be, just as you say, offering their conclusions in public, and that will, of course, be vulnerable to the claim that we don't see the evidence, and so forth. But you're leaving out, I think, all the mechanisms that have been created for sharing intelligence with congressional leadership. The senior members of Congress, the chairman of the intelligence committees in both houses, and the majority-minority leaders get access to pretty detailed information.
And but they also cannot share that.
They can't share it, but they will have seen the evidence, and they will be able to say what their conclusion is based on the evidence they've seen. They should not share the evidence, and we've gotten to the point where actually, there's some risk here of compromising sources and methods in a way that hurts the country.
Right.
But nevertheless, the administration is not going to be able completely to hide behind the claim that, well, this is just a difference of opinion. They are going to face the risk that senior members of Congress are going to say, we've seen the evidence and we think it doesn't say what you do.
It's not obvious, though, what the policy consequences and ramifications of that will be, though.
It's absolutely right, although some members of Congress have said, well, if we come to the conclusion that the Russians were trying to do this, then we have our own ideas as to what the appropriate countermeasures should be. And in any case, we will want to hear from the administration what its view of the appropriate countermeasures should be. But people in Congress are talking about sanctions against Russia. And if the administration tries to make this a make or break issue, it's going to be very difficult. Now, typically, administrations try to get ahead of congressional initiatives on this of this kind by saying, we're taking care of it. We agree with you it's a problem. We are going to deal with it in our own way. And then they usually are able to diffuse this. But this is a kind of wild card issue where
let's note that wild card because we're not sure how it is going to play out. And I take your point that it could very much constrain what it is that the Trump administration does, could put the administration on the defensive. But then again, the administration could find a way to take this and make it an opportunity and put it behind it. Let's talk about sort of rethinking relations with Russia, Steve, because obviously when we're talking about that, the United States and Russia are involved on lots of different issues. Sometimes perhaps their interests align, other times they don't. So let's maybe go through some of them. And again, the biggest one might be the future of NATO in Europe and this issue of sanctions. What is it you see this administration doing, and what are the sort of complicating factors there that people should be thinking about?
Well, the focus here is on two problems. One is sanctions in response to Russian aggression in Ukraine, and the other is the future of NATO, the character of the administration's commitment to it, its spending in Europe, its readiness to go ahead with deployment decisions that have been made over the past couple of years. First one, sanctions, raises the question of whether the Europeans will stick with these sanctions. Over the past couple of years, there have been repeated doubts as to whether the Europeans were prepared to keep this regime in place. And every time they have actually maintained unity and said, yes, we want to keep the pressure on the Russians until they live up to their agreements to withdraw from Ukraine.
So not just Angela Merkel, but other Europeans have been behind this.
All European governments have gone along with it. You have a rising level of dissent from a number of governments, and even in Germany, there is division on this question. So every time the issue comes up, every 6 months, there's uncertainty as to whether or not you'll have European unity maintained. If the Europeans think the United States wants to call the whole thing off, that will make it easier for the dissenters to carry the day. But it will still be awkward, because what dismantling the sanctions regime means is giving the Russians a get-out-of-jail-free card without good behavior in Ukraine. So the question is, can the administration get some kind of face-saving settlement in Ukraine, some concessions from the Russians showing that they are prepared to act more responsibly, respectfully toward Ukrainian sovereignty? The other issue is, of course, NATO. Here, Trump, as a candidate, tried to walk back his doubts that he raised about whether the United States would be committed to its NATO allies. But there's still the issue of, apart from the basic Article 5 commitment to the security of allies, there's the question of spending, whether the United States is prepared to carry through with some of the rather small buildup that the Obama administration committed to, including forward deployments of a small number of forces on some of the new frontline states in Europe.
Steve, on that, we have actually a clip from candidate Trump talking about the issue of spending by our allies. Maybe we can play it right now, because I have a question.
Okay.
our allies are not paying their fair share. And I've been talking about this recently a lot. Our allies must contribute toward their financial, political, and human costs, have to do it, of our tremendous security burden. But many of them are simply not doing so. They look at the United States as weak and forgiving and feel no obligation to honor their agreements with us. In NATO, for instance, only 4 of 28 other member countries besides America are spending the minimum required 2% of GDP on defense.
How do you imagine a President Trump might act on that, and how would the Europeans respond?
Well, the Europeans are all committed to spend 2% of GDP on defense, and most are increasing their defense spending, even though the number who've actually reached that level is still small. There will be a struggle. European governments are generally trying to show that they're doing more. The frontline East European states that are most worried about NATO's commitment to them are the ones that have been spending the most and increasing the most.
Estonia has met its 2% commitment.
Right. And the Baltic states in general and Poland in the past couple of years have increased, I think they're spending 45% since 2010, which is a, you know.
That's an increase over what they were spending.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So they are moving in the right direction. They're kind of the heroes of NATO, in fact. The issue of getting allies to spend more is a hardy perennial for American foreign policymakers. And I don't doubt that the Trump administration will stick with this line. And I also don't doubt that allies will make a lot of noise about being completely on board here. Whether you can get material increases in the short run is another question. But there will be material increases that actually leads to 2% of GDP being spent. That'll probably be hard to do.
Well, and there's also the question of whether
the direction will be good.
Right. But the other question is whether the money is spent on things that actually materially increase NATO's capabilities. There's no guarantee that will happen.
Absolutely. And there are various ideas that have been proposed for how you could try to make the requirement a little more pointed. Some people have suggested, for example, that NATO governments should formally ratify the 2% commitment, so there'd be some mechanism that would force increases. You can also create a mechanism within NATO directing members to achieve certain capabilities. That's all. That's the kind of issue that all the members of the alliance have argued about for years and years and years.
One of the aspects of the NATO tensions with Russia, back to your earlier point, is obviously the Ukraine, the post-2014 developments. And you mentioned something along the lines of potentially, you know, a quick win on the Ukraine front could help diffuse some of the tensions. Can we talk a little bit more of that? Is this sort of Russia manifestly doing something in eastern Ukraine or helping the Minsk process, this sort of dormant process, advance in a way that builds confidence and suddenly you take some of the tension out of the air? I mean, we've had this – the administration will be taking office at a time when the Russians have moved missiles to Kaliningrad. They're continually buzzing into NATO airspace in the Baltic – over the Baltics. And people have described, you know, a very tense situation in competing airspace. So do you see Ukraine as being the key to maybe something in Ukraine as a possibility to walking things back?
Yeah. If Putin wanted to make it easier for Trump to justify a warmer, more cooperative relationship, there are a number of things he could do. He could kind of stand down some of the confrontational activities, the buzzing that you refer to. He could slow down the deployments in Kaliningrad. He could, above all, try to come up with some new initiative on Ukraine. My own view is that this is not out of the question because I think the whole Russian enterprise in eastern Ukraine has been a loser for them. And if they wanted to find a way to extricate themselves, this is a perfect moment. The advent of Trump is an opportunity for the Russians to respond to this outreached hand from the new American president and to show that, you know, we can turn the page. That would mean probably cutting off some of their pals in eastern Ukraine, doing something to make it clear that they're pulling their forces out, sealing the border, turning control over to the Ukrainian government. Probably won't go all the way there, but this would be a perfect opportunity for Putin to give his pal Trump a boost.
The Crimea is a done deal.
That, I think, is never, under President Putin at least, going to be reversed. It is the source of his renewed popularity. Russian commentators refer to what they call the Crimean consensus as the new basis of legitimacy for the Putin regime. He can't give that back, and Western governments don't have to acknowledge that Crimea is part of Russia. They just have to focus on eastern Ukraine as the immediate area where they want Russians to backtrack.
Steve, let's change geographical areas and let's talk about the Middle East. Obviously, two big issues there. One is the issue of Syria and related to the Islamic State. Second issue about Iran and where policy might go there. Let's talk about first the immediate issue of Syria. We've seen Aleppo fall. It has fallen in large part because the Syrian government had the very active support of the Russian military. How do you see U.S. policy towards Syria, work with Russia, going forward now?
Well, to me, what Trump and some of his advisors have said about Syria is a little mysterious. Of course, what the Russians have done in Aleppo doesn't involve fighting ISIS. ISIS right. is not in Aleppo. And for the Russians to turn their attention to a real campaign against ISIS would be to get them to focus more on those parts of Syria that have been held actually by ISIS across the border from Iraq, where the United States and the Iraqi government are trying to fight ISIS.
Or we just saw in Palmyra that the Russians made a big show of staging a concert there after it had been recaptured, and now it's gone back into ISIS hands.
Apparently, it left a fair amount of materiel behind that the ISIS fighters have claimed, including, I'm told, surface-to-air missiles.
The campaign against Aleppo has been important for the Assad regime. It hasn't done much to weaken ISIS. And to get Russia
No, you're right. I mean, they're really two separate battles. But the Russians portrayed this as they were intervening to fight against terrorism when it was
actually
That's
because they've said that everybody who opposes the Assad regime is a terrorist and is essentially an ISIS ally. But getting the Russians to pivot toward a real campaign against ISIS will be something more complicated.
And that's what Mr. Trump has said he hopes to make happen, make common cause the United States and Russia against the Islamic State.
Yeah. The Russians haven't shown any particular interest in doing this, and it will be a challenge for them and the Assad regime. The Assad regime doesn't really have the ground forces to undertake this. And air power alone isn't going to do it. So I haven't yet heard the case for how the Russians are going to be really important in this campaign. The United States has a much better chance, as I understand the situation, of actually encroaching on ISIS territory in Iraq and then moving
Well, we have right now Mosul is under attack. Absolutely. They've penetrated the outer rings of Mosul.
Yeah. You know, I think one of the ironies of this is that the Obama administration actually has a more robust campaign against ISIS than the Trump administration has allowed, and certainly much more than Putin has undertaken. So exactly what the nature of this cooperation is a little bit mysterious to me. But you know, perhaps Mr. Trump knows something we don't know.
What about Iran? The candidate Trump, at least, threatened to tear up the Iran nuclear deal. That is a deal that was ironed out between Iran and the P5 plus one, the permanent members of the Security Council plus Germany. One of those permanent members is Russia. As best I can tell, the Russians are very supportive of the deal.
Yeah, if Trump backs away from the deal, he's not going to have Putin's support. This is an issue where the United States and Russia are bound to be at odds. The Russians very much value their relationship with Iran and have found That the deal offers new opportunities for them because the removal of sanctions means that they can expand their own economic relations with Iran and their military cooperation as well. Trump will get some pushback if he wants to try to undo that deal. He sure won't have any support from Putin on it.
One of the other aspects of this situation we find ourselves in approaching the new administration is the advent of what some policy analysts are saying is a new era of information warfare, Steve, in terms of what Russians have been accused of doing in hacking and in spreading so-called fake news reports, not only in the U.S. but in other places. There's concern that this will start happening more frequently in Europe as you start seeing elections taking place in the Netherlands, France, and then later in the year in Germany. Do you see any sort of concerted effort, whether or not it's the administration or it's some of these other policy community voices, to do something to counter Russia's voice on the airwaves, whether it's in the U.S. or in Europe?
This is a tough one for a Trump administration because it clearly, this campaign that you talk about, clearly involves the expansion of Russian interest across Europe. The Russians were big enthusiasts of Brexit. They're big enthusiasts of Trump. They're big supporters of Marine Le Pen in France.
They've actually been providing financial support, as I understand it, correct?
A bank under Russian auspices offered a loan to Le Pen's party.
And Orbán in Hungary and so forth.
Exactly. But Trump himself has been a pal and a booster of all of these efforts. So it's a little difficult for him to identify this as a threat. He has been on the phone to Orbán in Hungary. And
Orbán warmly greeted his election.
Orbán is going to visit the United States early in the president's term. I'm not quite sure how a Trump administration will be able to identify this as a problem that requires pushback. But it's going to become more of a problem. That's for sure. If you imagine the review underway in Russia of their overall effort, crowned with the election of Donald Trump, the people who are in charge of this information warfare campaign are going to be getting more awards, more money, more enthusiastic support from the Kremlin. So it's going to become a more vigorous part of Russian policy. I think there's no doubt about that.
The administration also finds itself with the ability potentially to influence U.S.-funded international broadcasting with the dissolution of the Board of Broadcasting Governors. I guess that's possibly another area to keep an eye on in terms of changes in the way the U.S. covers that part of the world.
Well, I think this is an issue where you're going to find the Congress and the federal bureaucracy and the media especially interested in highlighting the problem and even devoting resources to it. The Congress is surely going to increase funding for American broadcasting. The federal bureaucracy is sure to push for more of an effort in this area. The media are going to be exposing Russian initiatives. So the administration is going to find itself in an environment in which a lot of people are going to be asking, what are you doing to deal with this problem? And I think it's not going to be quite enough for the administration to say, what problem?
Steve, I'm going to ask you to put your geopolitical hat on. One of the remarkable things about how Mr. Trump has talked about foreign policy has been that he has spoken very warmly about Russia and about the possibilities for improving U.S.-Russian relations. On the other hand, he's talked very tough about China. He's raised questions about whether he's going to adhere to the one China policy. He has spoken quite emphatically about how he sees China preying on the United States economically. And so that raises, I guess, the broad, maybe geostrategic question of whether he's engaged in what I might call a reverse Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon opening to China to put pressure on the Soviet Union. Are we looking at Donald Trump and his team thinking that they can make an opening to Russia to put pressure on China? Or is that overthinking it?
Well, I'm sure that there will be people inside the administration trying to recapture the glory of triangular diplomacy and saying that this is something just as brilliant as what Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger did. I think the environment is a little different. China is such a robust and growing force in international politics that it will be hard to make Russia an ally in quite the same way against against China. But there's no doubt that in a sort of fact of life terms, a closer Russian-American relationship will be noticed by the Chinese, noticed by other American allies in Asia as an ingredient in a policy of trying to restrain Chinese power. But I think the key here is going to have to be deciding what the strategy toward China is, and that's going to have to be a set of decisions taken without much reference to Russia. Russia can't be the kind of dramatic new ally in a policy toward China that China was toward the Soviet Union 45 years ago.
Steve, let's stay in the region and talk about another challenge, another threat in the region facing the U.S. and that Russia might have a role in helping to address, which is North Korea. In a previous President's Inbox podcast, our colleague Liz Economy mentioned that there's no love lost between the leaders of North Korea and China, and that China still is the crucial country there. But we don't hear much about Russia's role, and Russia was part of the six-party talks that have been dormant for a long time. It has some connections in North Korea. What can Russia bring to the table on the North Korea front?
Well, one thing, of course, is its vote in the Security Council, and the Russians have supported increased sanctions against North Korea. They have been seen as the kind of junior partner in trying to build up pressure. The Chinese obviously take the lead here. But if you could get a significant increase in Russian willingness to put pressure on North Korea, that could be paraded by a Trump administration as one of the signs that its Russian reset was working. The challenge here, of course, will be to get the Chinese ready for a more robust set of pressures on North Korea. It's right to think of the Russians as the junior partner, but if you got Russian support, it would make it harder for the Chinese to stand alone as the backers of a more cautious, go easy, go slow policy toward North Korea. So the Russians could have some value here, and if the Trump administration wanted to make that one of the items on its wish list for a new relationship with the Russians, that wouldn't be a bad idea.
Any reason why the Russians wouldn't make that offer, Steve? It seems like an easy concession for them to make to allow a Trump administration to claim victory.
It's true. On the other hand, the Chinese may be saying to them, listen, let us handle this. You just step aside and we'll take the lead here. So they want to be sure not to antagonize the Chinese. The Russians are playing an interesting game in East Asia. Putin is visiting Japan this month.
First visit to a G7 country since the sanctions.
Absolutely. And he has preceded it with a lot of suggestions that he may be prepared to make unprecedented concessions to the Japanese on the Northern Islands, wants to expand relations. Japanese businessmen tell me that they have been under a lot of pressure from the government to offer up gifts and deliverables for Putin when he arrives. There's a real effort here to expand that relationship as part of, I would think, an overall effort to show the Chinese that they too have other options. The Russians have traditionally had a kind of wary feeling about the rise of Chinese power and have wanted to expand their relations with other countries in the region. They've done so relatively successfully with the South Koreans. They haven't been able to do so with the Japanese. And of course, their relations with the U.S. Have been bad. If they can improve relations with both the Japanese and the U.S., that will be a big advance for them.
So we've talked a lot about state to state and relations, geopolitics. There is a Russian domestic question as well. Recently, I guess one of the lead domestic challenges to Mr. Putin is Alexei Navalny, and he's announced he's interested in running in the 2018. So maybe a populist campaign in Russia itself. Steve, can you talk a little bit about what Russia's facing domestically in terms of any stresses we should be keeping an eye on?
Well, Putin has come out of this year politically virtually unchallenged in Russia. He won a big victory in the parliamentary elections, and he's looking forward to a re-election campaign either next year or the year after, which he is very likely to win as well. Putin has made clear in his very, very negative reaction to some not too serious criticisms that Hillary Clinton made of the parliamentary elections in 2011, that he doesn't appreciate any interference in Russian politics. And I think that's going to be a message that he delivers loud and clear to the new administration. But it's another tough one for Trump, because it represents such a retreat from an historic American commitment to the advancement of human rights and democratic norms in the former Soviet bloc. That's why you have the Magnitsky legislation, which has been recently expanded by the Congress.
Which is basically it's punishing, it's inhibiting Russian travel, and it's setting sanctions, sort of targeted sanctions on people seen to be involved in human rights abuses.
Absolutely. And the Trump administration is going to be under a lot of pressure, again, from the Congress, from the NGO community, from the media, and even from inside the federal bureaucracy, to show that it hasn't totally abandoned that question. I mean, American values have been an important part, at least of the rhetoric of American leadership. And the president is going to have to make clear whether he's totally abandoning this or just approaching it in a different way. Here, too, he's going to want to show that he can achieve some of the same goals that other leaders have pursued, but by different means. This is going to be difficult for him because Putin isn't going to want to give him much.
Well, on that note, we're going to close up the president's inbox for this week. Steve, thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure.
Be sure to subscribe to the president's inbox on iTunes and leave us a review. It really helps. Please note that opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's episode was produced by Kevin Lizarazzo with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock and recording engineer Dan Mudd. Also, special thanks to Audrey Bowler and Bardia Viseggi. This is Jim Lindsay.
And this is Bob McMahon. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on the President's Inbox.